A honeymoon is a time that's associated with the joys and thrills of marital intimacy. Honeymoons are filled with fun-filled days, amorous evenings, romantic dinners, walks in the moonlight under starry skies. Honeymooners are focused on each other and the good qualities that they see in one another. Rarely do they see the bad qualities. Honeymoon love is kind of a gushy, giddy kind of a thing. You only focus in on the positives, and you're sort of blind to the negatives. On the honeymoon, the marriage is happy and harmonious, but all too often, the honeymoon comes to an end too quickly. On the honeymoon, the sexual part of the relationship is like a sweet sauce poured over a delicious dessert. But the sexual part of the relationship begins to drag, and it begins to wane when the honeymoon fires die and when the couple begin to face the realities of living together, two imperfect human beings trying to work through problems and staying committed to one another. I ran across a list of 7 ways to identify when the honeymoon is over. Maybe you'll relate to some of these ways. The honeymoon is over when he phones that he'll be late for supper and she's already left a note that it's in the refrigerator. The honeymoon is over when the dog brings your slippers and your wife barks at you. The honeymoon is over when she complains about how much noise he makes while fixing his own breakfast. The honeymoon is over when he no longer smiles gently as he scrapes the burnt toast. The honeymoon is over when he finds out he married a big spender and she finds out she hasn't. The honeymoon is over when the wife stops making a fuss over her husband and begins to make a fuss with him. And the honeymoon is over when the bride goes from saying, "I do," to saying, "You'd better." I ran across a poem entitled "Marriage at an Early Urge." And it describes how our early feelings toward each other can sometimes fade in the marriage relationship. Listen closely. "Nice night in June, stars shine, big moon. On date with girl, heart pound, head swirl. Happy girl, happy boy, me say, me love, she coo like dove. Me smart, me fast, never let chance pass. Get hitched, me say, she say, okay. Wedding bells, ring ring, honeymoon, everything. Settle down, married life, happy man, happy wife. Another night in June, stars shine, big moon. Ain't happy no more, carry baby, walk floor. Wife sad, me mad. Life won, big spat. Nagging wife, bawling brat. Me realize at last, me too fast." Marriage at an early urge. It's amazing how the feelings that were once so strong can sometimes fade and flicker. Solomon and the Shulamite had had a whirlwind romance. He had come in and swept her off her feet. They had a satisfying honeymoon. And they had finally settled down into the normal routine of being husband and wife, and in their case, king and queen. Solomon was working late at the office. The Shulamite was involved in her new busy life. And in chapter 5, we begin to find that the newlyweds are having problems. The honeymoon is now over, and they are faced with having to cope and deal with these problems. Let's begin in chapter 5, verse 2. The Shulamite begins, "I sleep, but my heart is awake. That's another way of saying that she's having a dream. And she's about to tell us what she's dreamt. Now, as we said before, dreams have three sources. They can either come from God, or they can come from the devil, or they can come from the pizza that you ate the night before. One of the three sources. You know, sometimes dreams are nothing more than aberrant surges of brain juices that stir images in your mind that have no relation to everyday life. But apparently her dream is from God. For in the dream, he warns her that she is developing some wrong attitudes towards her husband and towards the sexual relationship that they have with one another. She says, "It is the voice of my beloved. He knocks, saying, 'Open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is covered with dew, my locks with the drops of the night.'" Now, apparently Solomon has been at a state function. He has been entertaining dignitaries. He has been serving as the head of state. And the whole while the party's been going on, he's been thinking about his bride. And he's been longing for her and desiring to go to her, to make love to her. As soon as the party's over, he splits. And he runs to her bedroom and he begins to knock on the door and he asks her to come and to make love together. It must have been in the wee hours of the morning. For here he says that his clothes are soaked with dew. He's waited late. It's 3:30 in the morning, maybe. In Palestine, sometimes the dew is so heavy that it can soak your clothes. And so he comes and he knocks on the door, obviously waking her up. Now, the queen had her own bedroom, and that was the common customs in the palaces in the Middle East. And so he knocked at the door. She'd already bolted it for the evening. And so he knocked, expecting her to come and to open the door for him. Now, understand that this is not a smart move on Solomon's part. The fact that he's coming to his wife at such a late hour is really not showing much sensitivity to her. He's not taking into consideration that she's had a hard day too, that she's tired, and that she might not be ready for sexual intimacy. Joe Dillo, in his commentary on the Song of Solomon, describes in humorous fashion the nocturnal habits of the average American male. Let me read it to you. "Typical Elmer, the average American husband, comes home from work. He enters, nods briefly to the kids, grunts to his wife, asks if he had any mail, and then blankly stares at the 6 o'clock news. Elmer burps his way through dinner and then leaves his wife to clean up the kitchen, diaper the kids, do the laundry, vacuum the house, write letters to his parents. And she falls asleep totally exhausted around 9:30. In the meantime, Elmer has dozed off watching an old movie when suddenly around 1 o'clock, the Star Spangled Banner jolts him awake. He turns off the TV, dons his Roman toga, puts on his crown of ivy leaves, crashes into the bedroom and shouts, 'Let the games begin!'" Elmer wants playtime before night-night. He may even give her 60 seconds before favoring her with his "let's get down to business" virility. Good old hardworking Elmer just can't understand why his wife isn't passionately responding to his every initiative. His approach obviously is insensitive and selfish. Fellas, if you want your wife to respond enthusiastically to your sexual favors and to your initiatives, you need to be careful with your timing. You need to find a better time than 1 o'clock in the morning. Or if you're sitting there waiting for the game in extra innings to expire, you know, you've got a wrong attitude. You know, you need to be considerate of her and her feelings and of her day and how tired she might be. Solomon, of course, is guilty of not being sensitive to his wife's mood and her energy level, but the Shulamite is guilty of a far worse offense. She says, "I have taken off my robe. How can I put it on again? I have washed my feet. How can I defile?" Now, he's knocking at the door, you know, asking to come in and to sleep with her and make love to her. And she offers what I consider to be some pretty flimsy excuses. First thing she says to him is, "Oh, wait a minute. You know, I can't come to the door. I'd have to put my robe on." Now I can hear Solomon saying, "Wait a minute. It doesn't matter. Believe me. I could care less about the robe with what I've got in mind." Next, she has this fetish about clean feet. You know, she's already washed her feet. She's gotten in bed. She's not going to get up and walk across the floor and get her feet dirty again. She'll have to wash them again before she goes back to bed. She spurns her husband's sexual advances. It leaves him feeling rejected, frustrated. Ladies, there is nothing that will deflate your husband's fragile male ego quicker than you rejecting and refusing his sexual advances. When he begins to come on to you and you turn him off, you drive a dagger in his heart. Defeated, frustrated, he feels like giving up on the relationship when you treat him this way. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul says, "Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourself to fasting and prayer and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." You may not have realized it, but according to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, to spurn your spouse's sexual advances is nothing more than a sin. Your body is not your own. It belongs to your spouse and vice versa. And whenever your spouse initiates some sexual favors and wants and desires this, it's important for us to accommodate and it's important for us to give sexually to our spouse. There's only one set of conditions, according to Paul, where it's acceptable to God for husband and wife to restrain or to abstain from sexual relationships. And that's when it's done with mutual consent, when it's done for a short period of time, and when it's done for the purpose of prayer and fasting. It's wrong to use sex to manipulate your mate, or depriving your mate of sex in order to manipulate your mate or to get your way. It's wrong. Never allow sex to get used to control your mate. Sex is that part of the relationship where we should be willing to give freely and consistently and openly to our spouse. Heard of a letter that a man wrote to his wife. The letter reads as follows. "To my loving wife, during the past year, I've tried to make love to you 365 times. I've succeeded only 36 times. This is an average of once every 10 days. The following is a list of why I did not succeed more often. It will wake the children 27 times. It's too late 23 times. It's too early 15 times. It's too hot 16 times. It's too cold 5 times. Pretended to be asleep 46 times. Windows are open, neighbors will hear, 9 times. Backache, 26 times. Headache, 18 times. Toothache, 13 times. Got the giggles, 6 times. Not in the mood, 36 times. Too full, 10 times. Baby is crying, 17 times. Watched late TV show, 17 times. I watched late TV show, 15 times. Mud pack, 11 times. Company in next room, 11 times. You had to go to the bathroom, 19 times. Total, 329 times. During the 36 times I did succeed, the activity was not entirely satisfactory due to the following. 6 times you chewed gum during the whole time. 7 times you watched TV the whole time. 16 times you told me to hurry up and get it over with. 6 times I tried to wake you to tell you we were through. 1 time I was afraid I had hurt you, for I felt you move. Honey, it's no wonder I'm so irritable, your loving husband. A lot of wives get the feeling that if they give their husband a perpetual green light, that he's going to take advantage of them. That he's going to demand sex every night, a couple of times. But that's seldom the case. Isn't it interesting? When do you crave food the most? When you're on a diet. When you're on a diet, all you can think about is food, is it not? But hey, if you have total access to a refrigerator, I mean, you eat a little bit here and there and it satisfies you and you're not always preoccupied with it. Ladies, if you would give your husband that green light, if you'd let him have his full, you'd be surprised how little he'll think about it. How unpreoccupied he can become. Right now you think he's some kind of sex-crazed maniac. Always demanding it, always requiring it. But if you were to just open up to him and give him that green light and let him know that you loved him enough to be there for him and that you enjoyed the sexual experience and that you wanted to satisfy him, boy, how it would just take the pressure off. And now it would allow him just to relax and to know that he has a wife who loves him and who cares for him. One loving wife wrote, "If you are too tired to make love, there is nothing at all wrong with occasionally saying, 'Honey, I just don't think I can climax tonight, but I'd love to make you happy.'" The author in the book continues, "Then take him in your arms, give yourself to him, and whisper in his ear that you love him and are thrilled you can give him pleasure. He shouldn't be made to feel selfish if he makes such a request, and you are not being used, unless this happens all the time. There is no rule that a wife must reach orgasm every time. The central issue in sexual love is not having an orgasm. Rather, it is sharing mutual love." Some of our problems is that we put so high expectations on the sexual experience that we can't just enjoy being together and the warmth of caring and giving to one another. Remember what Paul said, that our sexual relationship, in order to be successful and satisfying, needs to be consistent. It needs to be a perpetual green light where either party can come to the other and can have their needs met and can be allowed to enjoy that intimate side of love and of marriage. This is what the Shulamite had denied Solomon. And apparently she felt very guilty about it rather quickly. She had spurned him and somehow she sensed that it had hurt him. Maybe by the tone of his voice on the other side of the door, and she realized, wait a minute, you know, I've hurt my beloved. And so she jumps up from the bed. And she runs to the door, and it says in verse 4, "My beloved put his hand by the latch of the door, and my heart yearned for him. I rose to open for my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the lock." It was common custom in Eastern countries for a lover to leave a little pouch of perfume or of myrrh, some kind of lotion, there in the opening of the door. It's kind of a symbol that he had been by, that he was there to see his lover, to see his spouse. When she grabbed the doorknob to unlock it, she had the myrrh all rolled down her wrist and on her hand, and she knew that he had left. She says, "I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone. My heart went out to him when he spoke. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer." She realized that he had left, that she had hurt him. And now she's sorry for what she's done, and she's running after him. Says, "The watchman who went about the city found me. They struck me. They wounded me. The keepers of the walls took my veil away from me." Now, of course, this would have never happened in real life. She's the queen. But remember, this is a dream. And perhaps she's feeling guilty over what she's done toward her husband. It says, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I am lovesick." Or literally, that I am sick for love. That I want my beloved. I want to speak to him. Now, before we go further, let me draw a spiritual parallel. How many times has our beloved, Jesus Christ, come to us and wanted to spend time with us? How many times have we sensed the warmth of his presence? How many times have we been drawn to study his word or to spend some time in prayer? How many times has he come to us desiring that intimate, beautiful spiritual relationship that he wants with his bride? And yet we've spurned him. We've offered all sorts of flimsy excuses. "Well, Lord, I'm tired. Well, Lord, there's a TV program that I want to watch tonight. Lord, I have a headache." How many times have we broken the Master's heart? When he's come to his bride, the church, desiring that beautiful intimacy for which he died, and yet we've ignored him or neglected him and refused to give him of ourselves. It's appropriate we feel guilty too, that we repent and that we seek him out to find his forgiveness. Now, the daughters of Jerusalem speak up in verse 9. "What is your beloved more than another beloved, O fairest among women?" What is your beloved more than another beloved that you so charge us? The Shulamite speaks, "My beloved is white and ruddy, chief among 10,000. Now, the Shulamite has lost her sexual desire toward her husband. And yet she takes steps to deal with the problem. She does so in two ways. First of all, she develops a new attitude toward her husband's body. Secondly, she reminds herself of an old attitude that she had toward her husband, the attitude she had when she first fell in love with him. And she recalls that he is her friend, of just what he means to her. And the combination of the two rekindle the sexual flame and stir up the passions in her. Perhaps tonight you've lost your sexual desire and longing for your spouse. The flame has flickered and died down. Here are two suggestions that will help you. First of all, she begins to think about her husband's body. Now, this arouses her. This rekindles the passions. Now, some of you wives probably never do that. You never think to do that. And yet it's biblical. It's important that you think towards your husband sexually. He is more than just a nice guy. He is more than just your provider or your breadwinner. He should be the object of your sexual desire. And you should think about his body and you should think about him in a sexual way if you want to keep these passions flowing. This is what she does. She says, "My beloved is white and ruddy." The word white there literally means dazzling or handsome. The word ruddy doesn't mean he had zits as a teenager. It means more reddish. Or he has a good color about him. You know, he's attractive. He's got that great tan, you know, from being outside and all. She says his head is like the finest gold. It doesn't mean he's hard-headed either, you know. Again, it's a compliment. His locks are wavy and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves by the rivers of waters, washed with milk and fitly set. The colored iris against the white of his eyes remind her of a dove that's been bathing in milk. In other words, she's turned on by his eyes. He says his cheeks are like a bed of spices, like banks of scented herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. His hands are rods of gold, set with beryl. His body is carved ivory, inlaid with sapphires. Now again, we talked about last week how that Solomon, in relating to his bride sexually, and vice versa, how that they would use poetic symbolism. That they didn't use slang terms. That would be crude and crass and really degrading. But neither did they use medical terms. I mean, that's very unromantic. And so they came up with these beautiful little poetic ways of talking about each other and expressing their sexual desire. Here's one of them. She says that his body reminds her of carved ivory inlaid with sapphires. Apparently, she's thinking about the parts of his body that have been shielded from the sun, that remain snow white. His sexual organs in the areas and all. And the inlaid with sapphire, she's thinking about the blood vessels that are running underneath the white of the skin and all. She's craving her husband's body. You know, this is what we need to be doing. There's nothing wrong with this. There's nothing wrong with a holy longing and desire for our spouse. Sex is good. And it's a beautiful thing in the marriage relationship. She goes on and she says, his legs are pillars of marble set on bases of fine gold. His countenance is like Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. Yes, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Now, understand that she sees her husband in two ways. First of all, she sees her husband as her friend. And this is very important. Fellas, that you're not only her lover, you're not only a Casanova, you're her friend, and you should be her friend first and foremost. She needs to feel secure in your love. She needs to know that you respect her as a person, not just as a sexual object. That you care about providing for her and protecting her as an individual. And as she feels secure in your love, then that will free her to become more uninhibited and free in her lovemaking. You see, men and women conceptualize intercourse in different ways. For the man, his tendency is to think of it as a conquering or as a possessing. Whereas the woman has the opposite view. She tends to think of it more as a giving away. Or as a surrendering, a letting go. And in order for her to let go, she has to be confident and secure in her knowledge of your love and your sensitivity to her needs. She will be free and uninhibited when she knows that you're in it more than just for sex. That you care about her as a person. That you care about the family. And that you want to take care of her. And you're committed for life to do so. And yet, just thinking of her husband as a friend is not enough either. He's not only a friend, he is also a lover. And she needs to see him as the object of her sexual desire. One author put it this way. Do you think about your husband sexually, or do you just think of what a nice guy he is? Do you think of how great it is to make love with him, or do you think of him as that wonderful Father and provider. It is perfectly holy to think erotic sexual thoughts about your husband during the day. It's in the Bible. The author goes on and he says this. Too frequently, women cannot climax because they view their husband's sexual organs as separate from their husband, as a person. They would never daydream about their husband's body as the Shulamite did. It seems repulsive to them. This is a major cause of orgasmic dysfunction. Now, what she does is she changes her attitude towards her husband's body. She begins to see him as God's gift to her to satisfy her sexual needs. Ladies, you need to develop a love affair with your husband's body. Think about him. Relish the last time you had sex with him. Do you think of him as the chief among 10,000? Or as altogether lovely? He is both your friend and your lover. Now again, let's draw the spiritual parallel. For there are times in which our spiritual desire for Jesus Christ sometimes wanes and flickers. What do you do about it when it happens? Well, you should do the same thing that the Shulamite did. You need to begin to think about Jesus Christ. Begin to dwell on Him. Who He is. What He's done for you. What He plans to do in the future as He returns and establishes His kingdom. Do you think of Jesus as chief or fairest of 10,000? As altogether lovely? As we begin to think about Christ, it rekindles our desire for Him. It puts back into our spiritual life the passion and the longing for our Lord. Jesus, too, is both our friend and our lover. And if we're constantly holding Him up as the object of our spiritual desire, we'll be drawn to Him in a deeper, more intimate relationship. Now, the daughters of Jerusalem speak. Where has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Where has your beloved turned aside, that we may seek him with you? My beloved has gone to his garden, to the bed of spices, to feed his flock in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He feeds his flock among the lilies. Now, finally, she wakes up from her dream and she realizes that this is an important dream. This has taught her some important lessons about relating to her husband. Her attitude has changed and she can't wait to show Solomon. But Solomon is not there. He's away feeding the flocks, or in other words, he's at work. He's taking care of his flock, Israel. He's watching over the affairs of state. When he comes home, she's ready to apologize and tell him how sorry she is and show him that her attitude has changed and have a lot of fun making up. Now, notice how her husband responds when he comes home and finds her. After being spurned, after being rejected, after being told, oh, I'm too tired, I don't want to walk across the floor, I don't want to open the door for you. After all of that, I want you to notice how he responds. It's so beautiful. The beloved says, oh, my love, you are as beautiful as Tirzah, lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners. He's a king. He thinks in those terms. Turn your eyes away from me, for they have overcome me. Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Gilead. And as we said last week, that was a compliment. I told my wife this the other night, and it really got her goat. She said, bad joke. It says, your teeth are like a flock of sheep, which have come up from the washing. Everyone bears twins, and none is bearing among them. All your teeth are symmetrical, beautiful, and like, oh, I love you so much. Like a piece of pomegranate are your temples behind your veil. Now, I want you to notice, if you're here last week, you know, this is exactly how he addressed her on their wedding night. Is it not? The same language, the same feelings are being expressed. In other words, even though she has spurned him, even though she has rejected him, there is no bitterness in his voice. There is no anger toward her. His love for her is unconditional. And he reminds her that he loves her just the same today, after her mistake, as he did the first day they made love. Husbands, if you want to stifle your wife sexually, if you want to make it difficult for her to enjoy sex, then place a lot of demands on her. Put a lot of pressure on her to perform. And you will kill the little bit of sexual desire that she might have left. If you want to turn her off completely, say mean and cruel things to her after she doesn't respond the way you want her to. Fellas, you need to be gentle. You need to love her unconditionally. You need to accept and appreciate whatever energy level she puts in to that night's lovemaking. You need to thank her for it and appreciate her for it and compliment her and build her up. 1 Peter chapter 3 reminds us husbands. Husbands, dwell with your wives with understanding, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but on the contrary blessing, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. Not returning evil for evil. If she shuns you, if she rejects you, it's up to you not to take it personally, but to love her anyway. And when you do make love to her, encourage her and appreciate her. And through your gentleness and through your unconditional love, you will encourage her sexual desire. And you'll begin to fan the flame in her heart and make it easier for her to enjoy the sexual relationship. Again, notice the parallel in our relationship with Christ. How many times have we spurned Him? How many times have we ignored Him and neglected Him? And yet His love for us is just the same as it was the day He died for us on the cross. It's an unconditional love. He is not angry at us. We are justified in Christ Jesus. We are one with Christ. And He loves us and He cares about us. And it's because of His undying, unconditional love and grace toward us that we love Him. And the more we realize just how wonderfully He loves us and just how lavishly He's poured His grace out upon us, the more we want to love Him in return. That's how it works in relationships between husband and wife, and it's how it works in our relationship with Christ. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines, he says, and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her. The daughters saw her and called her blessed, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her. Technically, Solomon has a large harem. But in his heart, for the moment, the Shulamite is the only one. Just as Christ, you know, has His church in His heart. We are His only one. He cares about us. He loves each one of us as if there were only one of us to love, as St. Augustine put it. He says, now who is she who looks forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, awesome as an army with banners? And he finishes admiring her, loving her. The Shulamite says, I went down to the Garden of Nuts to see the verdure of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded and the pomegranates had blossomed. Before I was even aware, my soul had made me as the chariots of my noble people. Now, here she begins to describe how some of her problems began. It had begun with the change of season. Spring had sprung. And you remember, she was from the country, and so the fresh blossoms and all reminded her of the country. And though she loved Solomon, she also loved the country. And she was there. She was in the palace. She was there being the queen, being his wife. But at the same time, too, her heart was not in it. She was actually in her heart back home. She had realized that palace life was not what it was cracked up to be. That there were pressures there, too. And this was the underlying cause that had caused her to shun her husband. It was a waning of devotion. She was loosening up on her commitment toward him. She was focusing on the circumstances, the environment, the pressures, rather than focusing upon him and the commitment that she had made. Solomon says, along with his friends, "Return, return, O Shulamite. Return, return, that we may look upon you." Solomon calls her heart to return. You know, when you make a lifetime vow to another person, it's a step of faith. You don't really know what circumstances are going to come your way. You don't really know what pressures life is going to put you under. There are bound to be some ups and downs. There are bound to be some difficulties along the way. But you got to hang in there. You got to keep your heart in it. In order to please God and in order to make your marriage a success. You can't allow your heart to begin to wander. I see it happening. Your marriage is not what you cracked up to be, and so your heart begins to wander. You begin to think about what it would be like with someone else. You begin to wonder, well, maybe I made a big mistake here. Maybe I didn't marry the right person. Maybe I was out of the will of God. It doesn't really matter what the will of God was before. What matters is that the moment you say, "I do," you did. And that became God's will for your life. And your heart begins to wander. It's because of a lack of commitment. It's because you're not taking seriously the vow that you made. There was a letter sent to Ann Landers. And let me read you just a portion of it. "In the commercials, husbands have endearing flaws, and wives look cute when they get mad. The message is that we need only to sift through the fish in the sea, and we will find the perfect one. Just throw back the ones you didn't like and keep looking. We have not been taught to work through problems that arise in relationships, nor have we been given realistic expectations of what marriage is all about. No one tells us that patience, determination, trust, and good communication must supplement love in order to make a marriage work. Marriage is not a bed of roses. And you think that getting married to someone is going to end your problems? Forget it. There are difficulties that arise when two imperfect people begin to share their life together and try to relate together. Man, sparks fly. They're bound to happen. And if you want your marriage to be a success, you've got to be determined to work through those problems and make it a success. It requires some good old-fashioned grit. This business of revolving door marriages, oh, this is not going to work out, so I'll find somebody else. And then they're with each other for a couple of years, and then they find someone else. After three or four failed marriages, man, you begin to think that the common denominator in all this is you. Marriage is not, write this down. Marriage is not so much finding the right person as it is being the right person. Requires some good old-fashioned grit and determination. Too often we enter the Christian life with false expectations. We think that by giving our life to Christ, that's going to end all our problems. The Christian life is a bed of roses, and we're not prepared for the trials that come, for the persecution that comes. And so many tuck tail and run when the going gets rough. The Christian life also requires some good old-fashioned grit and determination. It takes guts to stand against the crowd and be a Christian. Hey, you want to be a wimp? Just go with the flow, man. Just get out there and do what everybody else is doing. But if you really want to stand up for something that matters, if you believe the truth, you need to be faithful to it. And you need some grit and determination and have guts enough to stand up and be different and count for Christ. In the end, that's all that's going to matter anyway. You need to decide that now. I kind of forgot where I was at. Got caught up in that. Verse 13, the Shulamite responds. Now what would you see in the Shulamite? As it were, the dance of the double camp. Or in the Hebrew, the dance of the Mahanaim. Now, in order to show her renewed love and the change of attitude that she's had toward her husband, the Shulamite decides that she's going to dance for him. Now, understand, this is not a foxtrot or a square dance that she gets involved in here. She dances for him in a very sensual, seductive manner. You've seen the movies, you know, where the Middle Eastern girls run out and they the negligees and all, and they start swaying and, you know, for the king and all. This is what she does for him. This is the dance of the Mahanaim. This is a very sensual dance that she performs for him. Now, he's watching her dancing as he describes her. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. Now, this is the last stitch of clothing that he'll mention. Apparently, the only thing she's wearing here is sandals. He says, the curves of your thighs are like jewels, the workman of the hands of a skillful workman. The curves of your thighs could be better translated, the vibration of your hips. Solomon is actually describing her movements as she dances. Your navel is a rounded goblet, which lacks no blended beverage. Your waist is a heap of wheat set about with lilies. Now, the heap of wheat was wrapped or tied together by twine that went right around the middle and pulled it tight. So it gave the sheaf of wheat an hourglass figure. And he's saying that she too has this hourglass figure. He's complimenting her on her slender waist. He says, your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are like the pools in Heshbon by the gate of Bath Rabim. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon, which looks down toward Damascus. Again, fellas, I don't recommend you use that one on your wife. Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel, and the hair of your head is like purple. Now, apparently, purple's the color of royalty, and so he's referring to her majestic appearance, how that her hair makes her majestic. Either that or she's a punk rocker, I don't know. The king is held captive by its tresses. In other words, he's saying, metal chains couldn't hold me, but I'm captured by the locks of your hair. He says, how fair and how pleasant you are, O love, with your delights. The stature of yours is like a palm tree, and your breast like its clusters. I said, I will go up to the palm tree. I will take hold of its branches. Let now your breasts be like clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples, and the roof of your mouth like the best wine. Now, in the Middle Eastern countries, the palm trees were artificially fertilized. The process required a man climbing up to the top of one palm tree and taking the male pollen and then climbing up the other palm tree and placing it in the female flowers. And that was the process by which the palm trees were fertilized. So Solomon here, and in making reference to climbing palm trees, he's saying that he's about to fertilize her. In other words, he wants to make love to her, is what he's saying. He's seen his darling dancing, and it's turned him on, and he's ready. says, the wine goes down smoothly for my beloved, moving gently the lips of sleepers. Apparently they have had intercourse now, and so they just sort of fall asleep in each other's arms. I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. Now let me say a few things about the dance of the Mahanaim. A survey was taken of 500 husbands. And these 500 husbands were asked the question, what is the biggest dissatisfaction in your sexual relationship with your wife? 39% wanted their wives to be more aggressive. Ladies, your husband wants you to show some initiative in the lovemaking. He wants you to communicate to him that you long for him as much as he longs for you. You know, you got to hand it to the Shulamite. She understands that men are turned on by sight. It takes a lot more than just sight to turn on a woman. We talked about this last week. But a man, you flash him a little leg and man, he's there, you know. He is turned on by sight. And so the Shulamite, she recognizes how nature works. And so she goes with the flow. And she begins to appeal to his sight in this dance. It's important to remember that God sanctions nudity in the marriage relationship. He says it's okay. One author puts it this way. Nudity between husband and wife has nothing, repeat, nothing to do with the virtue of modesty. Totally different issue. In the intimacy of marriage, undressing for each other should be as natural and unselfconscious as a shared laugh or a mutual prayer. Perhaps you're not a very good dancer. Of course, I imagine your husband wouldn't care. But maybe dancing's not your thing. There are other ways of appealing to his sight and to his visual, stimulate him visually. One night he comes home from work. Why don't you meet him at the front door wearing your sandals? Maybe some jewelry. If you're real shy, wear a lot of jewelry. Again, though, the spiritual application. It's interesting, but the more we fall in love with Jesus Christ, the more uninhibited we become in our worship of Him. The freer we are to close our eyes or to raise our hands, to really express to Him our love. You know, the more intimate we become with Him, the more familiar we become with Him, the freer we are in telling Him how much we love Him. It's no longer an issue to pray in public. We don't think anything of it. We're ready, you know. We're excited to be able to express our love for the Lord. You remember David? He was so overwhelmed in his love for the Lord that there were several times when he just danced before the Lord. Just in a free, uninhibited expression of praise and worship. And so we see the parallels. I don't dance in public. You know, this is not my style, you know. And God doesn't want you to be anything that you're not. And there's some times, though, in my private devotions, in my time with the Lord, when He blesses and I check. Here at the church, you know, He's just blessing and the socks off of us. And you get so excited about what the Lord is doing. And I just kind of walking down the hall and I check, make sure Judy's not looking and James is in his office. And I'll just do a jig for the Lord, you know, right there in the hall. You know. You just love the Lord so much, you know. You just got to find ways of telling Him and expressing it to Him. And, you know, the more you love Him, the more He blesses, the more free you are in being able to express that. Verse 11, she says, come, my beloved, let us go forth to the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine has budded, whether the grape blossoms are open, and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. Now, the Shulamite is from the country, and here she's asking Solomon to take her on a vacation, a second honeymoon. They've had some problems, and so it'd be nice to get away so that they could make up. And so she's suggesting that they go off to the country, and she says, hey, let's go. And she promises him her sexual favors. She says, the mandrakes give off a fragrance, and at our gates are pleasant fruits, all manner new and old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved. Oh, that you were like my brother who nursed at my mother's breast. Now, that's just an expression. She wants him close to her breasts. If I should find you outside, I would kiss you. I would not be despised. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother. She who used to instruct me, I would cause you to drink of spiced wine, of the juice of my pomegranate. She's, of course, talking about the sexual intercourse and the joys of it and all. Now, notice that she is initiating this. Ladies, she is being aggressive. She is suggesting all this to her husband in rather erotic terms. She is also promising him favors new and old. In other words, she is saying that she wants to be creative. There's some new things she wants to try on him. And she's wanting to be creative in her lovemaking. And I believe creativity is also an important part in a successful sexual experience. The same places, the same perfumes, the same positions, only breed boredom in a person's sexual experience. We need to be creative. Introduce a new wrinkle. Avoid getting in a rut. Take your wife to a hotel one night. I mean, her house is her workplace. How comfortable would you feel in really being lavish in your lovemaking somewhere at work? I mean, take her to a motel or a hotel one night. If you can't afford a hotel, pitch a tent in the backyard. Change the scenery a little bit. Change the environment a little bit. Be creative in terms of place and so forth. And change your perfume occasionally. Change positions occasionally. Just, be creative. She promises him things new and old. Now, his left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. Apparently, they're in the act of sexual expression. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. And again, she's warning those who are single. And she's tasting these sexual passions and the power of sexual passion. And she's saying, don't mess around with this. It's a narcotic. It's a drug. Fellas, let me say to you, nothing is more addictive than pornography. And if you begin to entertain yourself with pornography, you are getting hooked on a narcotic that is sure to destroy you. She's saying, be careful. Don't stir up these sexual passions until it's time. Until you've found the woman that God wants you to marry and live with for all your life, then it's time to begin to experience this display of oneness. You know, without those confines, without those protective commitments, you make yourself vulnerable to a person that you don't even know or a person who you're not sure is going to be there tomorrow. It's degrading. It's dehumanizing. You come away feeling cheapened that you've given something as precious as your most intimate personal part of yourself to someone that you don't even know, hasn't even promised you he'd be with you tomorrow. How degrading can you get? You feel like a piece of meat, a pacifier for someone else's sexual desires. He's warning you that are single. Reserve this for the time that's right, for that beautiful, intimate expression of marriage when it can become most meaningful, most fulfilling. Now, they are approaching the country, and a relative, maybe one of the brothers of the Shulamite, says, who is this coming up from the wilderness leaning upon her beloved. Now, remember, when the Shulamite left home, she was the little sister who had been in charge of tending the vineyard. But now she returns as queen of Israel. And her friends, her relatives, don't even recognize her. What an interesting parallel. Right now, you know, we're the peons of the world. We're the foolish of the world. You know, we're the unknowable. The world looks down on us that we've committed our life to Jesus Christ. They scoff at us. They think that we're next to dirt. How surprised they're going to be when we come with our beloved in the air. Him as King and King and Lord of Lords, and we riding with Him in order to rule with Him. How surprised they're going to be when they see us as royalty, as joint heirs with Jesus Christ. She recalls her past, or they recall her past for her, and they remind her, "I awakened you under the apple tree. There your mother brought you forth. There she who bore you brought you forth." The Shulamite says to her husband, "Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. In other words, be faithful to me. Help me be confident that you'll always be there. For love is as strong as death, jealousy as cruel as the grave. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame. Many loves cannot quench, many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it." You know, there are many things that can destroy a relationship. But where love is being expressed between two people, nothing can conquer or defeat love. Remember what Paul said to the Corinthians. He says, "Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails." Listen, couples, never give up on loving in your relationship. Never resort to manipulating. Never resort to selfishness. Wives, never resort to trying to control your husband. Husbands, never resort to trying to use your wife. Always make sure that your motivation toward your spouse is one of love. Unselfish, unconditional love. And your relationship will endure anything. The floods, the waters will not be able to quench your love. Love bears all. Love never fails. He says, "If a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised." You remember what Solomon said in the Proverbs. He said, "Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure with trouble. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fatted calf with hatred." You'll be living in a big old mansion on the hill. But if there's not love in that mansion, you'd just as soon be living in a shack on the other side of the railroad tracks. Man, what you want is not money, but love. Now, the Shulamite's brothers, they chime in. They had a part to play. They helped raise her. And they say, "We have a little sister, and she has no breasts." They remembered that. "What shall we do for our sister in the day when she is spoken for?" Now, they flash back to her youth, and they begin to describe the care that they gave her. Apparently, her brothers had an intimate part in raising her. And this was how they sort of protected her during her teenage years. They said, "If she is a wall, we will build upon her a battlement of silver. And if she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar." Now, what they're saying is that they were going to tailor their training and their care for her to her nature and to her disposition. If she was strong, if she was a stable, strong individual who had a mind of her own and who could resist the peer pressure that she was bound to face, then they would encourage that And they would sort of love her and allow her to carry on. If she could say no to the immoral demands of those men that would come and try to flirt with her and try to seduce her, you know, then they could give her more freedom, knowing that she was a woman of strength and character. But on the other hand, if she was a gullible person, if she had grown up to be someone who was easily influenced, who had more of a tendency to go along with the crowd, if she was a door, then they were going to have to enclose her, put some locks on that door, and put some more restrictions on her. Parents, that's good advice for how you ought to handle your teenage daughters. A lot of it depends on their disposition, their tendencies, their nature. And some people are just more gullible. Some people are just more have more of a desire and a need to please others, and they're more susceptible to peer pressure. And that kind of personality, you got to watch. They're a door. You got to board them up. Now, the Shulamite responds, "I am a wall." Apparently, the Shulamite had been someone who was strong, who had been someone who was stable. She was someone who, you know, had her own mind and wanted to maintain her virginity and her purity for her spouse. She says, "I am a wall and my breasts like towers. Then I became in his eyes as one who found peace." Now, as we've been reading this, it is obvious that the Shulamite was a very skilled lover. She knew how to sexually please her husband. I heard of a Christian speaker, a speaker at a ladies' conference. She made this comment to the ladies in attendance. She said, "You know, girls, a prostitute is skilled in all the techniques of giving sexual pleasure to a man she does not even know or love. If they can do that for a man just for money, surely we should be even more skilled in giving sexual pleasure to our husbands whom we do love." And yet, where did she learn her skill in lovemaking? It was not through experience. It was not through sleeping around. It was not through reading a sex manual. It was not through watching X-rated movies or reading Playboy magazine. That's not what enabled her to become a skilled lover. She says, "I'm a wall. I'm strong. I kept myself pure and a virgin." Where did she learn this skill in lovemaking? You see, what we need to understand is that skill in making love has nothing to do with experience. But it has everything to do with being a sensitive, unselfish, tender, loving person who takes the time to identify their mate's needs and who loves them enough to be patient with their own desires and try to meet the sexual needs of their spouse. A woman who gives her husband a perpetual green light, a woman who desires her husband and who takes the initiative in lovemaking, a woman who cares about her husband and communicates to her husband and wants to know what pleases her husband, that's a woman who will be skilled in pleasing and satisfying her spouse. She doesn't need anything else but those kinds of attitudes. You see, the Shulamite had plenty of opportunities. She says, "I am a wall, and my breasts are like towers." You know, when she grew up, buddy, she was a hot babe. I mean, her breasts attracted a lot of guys. And she had plenty of opportunities to go to bed with other men. And yet she refused. Her breasts were inaccessible. She kept herself pure. She maintained her virginity. Listen to me, those of you who are single. Living together. Going off on sexual excursions is not going to help you in the enjoyment of the sexual part of your marriage. As a matter of fact, your immorality is going to do more harm than good. Your experience, quote unquote, is going to become counterproductive. For you see, when sex is is experienced by two partners who are approaching it with the wrong attitudes and from the wrong motivations, it has a way of scarring your sexual psyche. It has a way of creating bad attitudes that you have to live with for the rest of your life. It has a way of producing scars that get in the way of your relationship with your husband or with your wife and can permanently cripple you from responding sexually as freely and as uninhibitedly as you possibly could or you could have otherwise. No, if you want to have a maximum sexual experience in marriage, keep yourself pure beforehand. Don't live together. Stay separate and stay pure until the day you get married. Again, what makes for a skillful lover is not experience. It's commitment. And it's communication. And it's unselfishness. And it's tenderness and it's caring. That's what is the skill in lovemaking. You've got those attitudes, you'll be a skillful lover. You'll satisfy your man. You'll satisfy your spouse, your wife. You won't have to worry about anything else. Everything else you'll figure out if you have those attitudes. A couple that makes a commitment for life, who loves each other with God's love, that's the couple who's going to experience the most free and uninhibited sexual expression. She says, Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He leased the vineyard to keepers. Everyone was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. My own vineyard is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and those who keep its fruit, 200. Now Solomon owned many vineyards, and it was his practice to lease these vineyards out to other people. In return, they would take and keep 20% of the profits and give the rest to Solomon. Apparently, a good vineyard would yield about 1,000 shekels, and so the keepers of the vineyard got 200 shekels. Now, what the Shulamite is doing here is she's just comparing herself to one of these fruitful vineyards. You know, she is saying, I'm a very valuable vineyard for you, Solomon. And, of course, we've talked about the imagery here. Vineyard and all is a way of saying that she's been his sexual partner. And she has been extremely valuable to him. And she's satisfied him. And she's pleased him. She's a vineyard that has produced 1,000 shekels worth of profit. And yet her brothers had a lot to do with her maturity as she grew up. And with her commitment. And with her remaining pure. Her upbringing had a lot to do with it. And here she's suggesting that perhaps Solomon should pay a bridal price and give to her brothers 20% of 1,000 shekels or 200 shekels as a token of his appreciation to how the brothers had raised her and all. Now, you who dwell in the gardens, and Solomon is now talking, the companions listen for your voice, but let me hear it. Apparently, she had gone back home, and some of her friends, her old girlfriends from the past and all, they'd come knocking on the door and all, wanted her to come and spend some time with them. But Solomon reminds her that this is the second honeymoon. He has other plans. He wants to make love to her. And she invites him, make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. And again, the mountains of spices, imagery of her, sexual favors And so again, she invites him to come and to make love, and the two of them are at it again. You know, let me tell you, just as we're to grow in different areas of our life, just as we're to grow in our work, our witnessing, in our fellowship one with another, likewise, we're to grow in our sexual experience with our spouse. Believe it or not, it's a part of Christian discipleship to learn how to please your spouse sexually. And we get a good example of it here in the Song of Solomon. Listen, it can be better than it is. Your sexual experience with your spouse can reach new heights. It can be fulfilling. It can be stimulating. It can bring a source of satisfaction and fulfillment to your marriage, if you'll do it God's way. If you'll seek God for wisdom and guidance. God loves you and He looks down at this area of your life and it's important to Him. It's not a peripheral issue. God wants, He created sex. And He created it to be enjoyed. It's not just for procreation, it's for pleasure. And He wants you and your spouse to have a beautiful, warm, pleasurable sexual experience. Give it some prayer. Give it some thought. Go back through. Read through the Song of Solomon. And have a lot of fun applying the Bible to your life.